one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Marvin?
This is Marvin Zimmerman, yes.
Marvin, if you just hold on, let me introduce the station, would you please?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I'm Joe Cristiano, and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, America's libertarian voice and independent streaming internet radio station broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to around the world. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Sunday evening, April 13, 2008. It is now about 8:01 p.m. Central Daylight Time of the good old USA. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, and self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620. That's 646-652-4620. Or email us at comments at libertytalkradio.com. Good evening, Marvin. Thank you very much for being on our show this evening. I'm sorry, I guess we got our lines crossed a little bit. I had asked your agent to give us a call around 5 minutes after the hour so we had time so we didn't have to keep you holding on the air. But that's fine
that's
with us if
fun.
It's okay with you. I did want to introduce you, and allow me to do so by reading your little biography from your website. Do you mind?
Absolutely, please.
Okay. All right. Marvin L. Zimmerman is 58, father of one son, Eric, who is 7, and married for 20 years to, and please pronounce your wife's name.
Macy.
All right. Very good.
Yeah.
I was afraid of mispronouncing your wife's name, and I didn't want to be accused of that. For nearly 15 years now, Marvin has been a publisher and editor of INMR Quarterly Review, a publication in the field of transmission and distribution of electrical energy with 20,000 readers worldwide. He is also chairman and organizer of the World Congress of Insulators, Arresters, and Bushings, something I've never heard of, I'll be honest with you, a biannual technical conference and exhibition which takes place in selected cities throughout the world. Marvin received his Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry and went on to complete his MBA in international business in 1972. Before starting INMR, he owned a small consulting firm specializing in international marketing. During this time, he traveled extensively throughout the world, visiting over 50 countries on all continents. He was also for many years a teacher of international business at two of Canada's largest universities, McGill and Concordia. Marvin's parents are both Holocaust survivors who managed to flee Poland just before the arrival of the Nazis. He was born in Salzburg, Austria, shortly after the war finished and immigrated to Montreal, Canada while still a child. The Ovum Factor, and that's your recent book, was written in Rio de Janeiro as well as the Amazon during a three-month period between October to December 2006. The images and experiences written into the plot of his novel are based on first-hand exposure to the jungles and rivers as well as visits to Indians living there. All his life, Marvin has been an ardent environmentalist and lover of the natural world. The plot of this novel is in many ways his reaction to the desperate situation faced by the planet as a result of humanity's unrelenting focus on growth without constraint. He wrote The Ovum Factor to help remind readers that our future ultimately depends on protecting the natural world as its survival depends on us. Very good. Good evening, Marvin. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, good evening.
It is really a pleasure and an honor. When I read your biography, I thought, what a colorful background. What experiences you must have had that I can only surmise about. I can't even imagine. I felt like my world was so small after reading about your travels and your experiences, especially that which occurred in the Amazon while writing your book. Could you just give us a little bit of a flavor and a little bit of a background to augment what I have just told, read to our listeners right here?
All right. As you mentioned in my biography, I have traveled extensively, mostly on business. And my travels, of course, have given me an opportunity to see the world and to see some of the problems that are inescapable to anybody who's visiting. And the Amazon was a place of great interest to me because it's the last frontier of nature, really, the last expanse without human activity, where nature dominates, and a place which has a profound effect on the world, an effect that many people don't understand and don't appreciate. One of the things that really struck me when visiting the Amazon is the scale. The size of the rivers is absolutely incredible. They look like lakes, not rivers. And to give you an idea of the scale of the Amazon River, which is the second longest river in the world, but the flow of water from the Amazon equals the flow of the next seven rivers combined.
Wow, okay.
So it's a huge river. In fact, in 1 minute, the amount of fresh water that's discharged by the Amazon into the Atlantic Ocean is enough to supply the freshwater needs of New York City for 65 years in 1 minute.
My goodness. Was the impetus for writing your book your travels to the Amazon, or what sparked you to write this? It's a novel, but really the novel is just a backdrop for the for actually your feelings of the environment itself. I mean, that you express yourself through a novel, I guess. Am I correct?
Yes, I do. The backdrop, the idea for this book, The Ovum Factor, came to me in a dream I had 10 years ago. I know it sounds perhaps a bit corny, but it is absolutely true. I dreamt this entire book, the detail of the plot, the characters, even the name of the book came to me in my dream. I woke about 3 or 4 in the morning, I don't even remember the exact time, and I was so stirred by this plot, by this idea, that I woke up Maisie, my wife, and I insisted that she listen to this story, and I said, please tell me, am I crazy or is this an incredibly interesting idea for a novel? If I'm crazy, I'll go back to sleep and we'll forget about it. But she listened dutifully and said, no, this is really good stuff. And the next morning when I woke, I remembered all the details because I had spent most of the night talking about them.
Allow me to confess that I did go to Borders to buy your book, and then I went to Borders called B. Dalton and other bookstores in our area, and your book was not in stock, but I could have ordered it, but I would have received it after the program. So I did not read your book. I did go on your website, and I read the excerpts from it. Can you give us just a brief summary of what the focus of the book is and where it brings us and where it's going to take us in
reality? Pleasure.
Please.
With pleasure. The Ovum Factor is what I would like to think of as an important new genre in fiction, an eco-thriller built around the imminent ecological catastrophe awaiting all of mankind, a catastrophe which in just 100 years has the potential to change all life as we now know it.
Right.
It's a thriller, an adventure built around the question of what if. And I suppose if I had to describe it in a few short words, I would say it's Dan Brown meets Michael Crichton meets Indiana Jones.
Okay, very good. Well,
it deals with a secretive society of scientists and world leaders, which has projected that due to climate change, disease evolution, and widespread pollution, human life as we now know it will disappear in less than 100 years.
Right.
And they're trying to find a way to stop this calamity.
Okay. You had 3 chapters on your website. I did read them. Folks, let me tell you, he's an excellent writer, and it's a fast read. It's a fast read because it's very engaging, and you wind up, I found myself reading faster and faster, and I'll admit that I am a slow reader. And I found that, and I really wanted to get that book in my hands, and unfortunately, I didn't have it in time. But there are many positions that scientists take, politicians, which we can excuse them for a minute, but that people who understand the environment take as to what is going on. There are many people who believe that the next worldwide global catastrophe will not be in the form of arms or missiles. It'll be in the form of a virus or some sort of ecological catastrophe, something that we will not expect and we will not anticipate. Thus, we will not know how to handle. Do you subscribe to that?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And in fact, that's the basis of the plot of the Ovum Factor. There's a scientist at Caltech who's trying to find a solution to this imminent catastrophe by creating a race of geniuses through a mystery molecule that expands the neural circuitry of babies while they're still in the gestation period. Mm-hmm. And he feels that the problems that await humanity are so intractable, so entrenched, so difficult to find a solution to, that we need an entire generation of geniuses to find solutions to problems that we've created.
Yep. It seems this is at a time where we seem to be getting dumber. I mean, you hear the expression, our butts are getting bigger and our brains are getting smaller. My son bought me a DVD a couple of weeks ago, Idiocracy. He says, "Dad, this fits. You will love this movie. It's kind of a dumb movie, but it talks about a guy who is thrusted in the year of 2550, and he's an average Joe Blow today, but in that year, he's brilliant because the world got so dumb." Anyway, but I mean, it's along the same lines, and it looks like we need to be smarter, and it doesn't seem that we are getting much smarter overall. We're becoming more complacent.
In fact, the one of the leaders of this secretive society is a billionaire investment banker in his 80s, and he says, which something that I personally believe, that the scale of environmental pollution is so great that babies being born today are born with impairments in their normal brain structure. For example, heavy metals have found their way into our water supply, into our food supply, and it's well known that heavy metals such as lead can impair the development of intellectual activity in humans. In fact, some historians believe that the collapse of the Roman Empire was due to the fact that the Romans ate with utensils based on lead. Eventually, they all became halfwits.
Well, you know, that really is interesting. My wife is from Oklahoma. I'm originally from New York. Now, if you are familiar with New Yorkers, we will stop anyone in the street and start a conversation. You know, we don't have to know the person, but anything to keep the mind going. And here it seems in Oklahoma, no one wants to talk about anything. And my wife often says, and she's from a small town of Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and she says, "We have lost the ability to converse." And that says a lot. That's a profound statement when you hear that. We have lost the ability to converse.
Yes.
And
part of it is, of course, related to our education and our culture. And that's something that I think is a lot easier to change than the more intransigent and more long-term effects of pollution, which are affecting our brains.
Yes.
For example, it's well known now that there's a substantial increase in childhood problems such as autism. And I think the only possible explanation is pollution. And pollution is not a regional problem. It's a global problem. For example, when they're burning coal in China, it's not a problem only for the Chinese. It's also a problem for us because the mercury and other heavy metals, which are
correct,
emitted as part of the smokestack emissions, find their way across the Pacific, end up in the salmon on the west coast of North America, which we end up eating in New York delicatessens,
right,
or in our supermarkets anywhere in North America.
Right.
So their problem is very much our problem.
Right. In fact, my wife was eating salmon almost every day, and she got some mercury poisoning. And this was very recently, and she had a stop eating salmon, and now we buy it from a place that sells salmon, which is mercury-free and all this other stuff. Cost a fortune, but that's where we buy our salmon from. So, and so we have some personal experience with that. I think we are on the same page. I think we're sometimes where so many people differ, and with all the best intentions, is really, what do we do about it? For example, I was recently speaking with Robert Bryce, who wrote that book. In fact, he was here in Tulsa, and I got to meet with him. Gushing lies, and he talks about the environmental movement. The alternatives to oil, you know, and some of the lies that they say about that. It's very interesting. For example, he says that, you know, we did not sign the Kyoto Treaty. However, our emissions are down. Spain, who did sign the Kyoto Treaty, their emissions are 30% above what they agreed to do. So it looks like we're going in the right direction. And one reason is that we're losing so much of our industry and we're becoming more of a service economy. So, we, you know, and we've already knocked down. But also a friend of mine who's also up on this stuff said that we have, in America, we have large forests that we continue to replant. And because we have such large forest areas, our ecology is really a little bit better than most places where they chop everything down and then never replace it. Oh, and by the way, I apologize. I have the flu tonight, and this is the third time I'm having the flu, and I can't figure out why I keep on getting this stupid thing, but it's driving me nuts. So I apologize if I sound funny.
Joe, let me comment on what you just said about forests. It's well-known fact that the carbon dioxide emissions that enter the atmosphere, it takes 100 years for the natural world to absorb 50% of those emissions. 100 years.
Right. Okay.
So the fact that we have forests doesn't mean that whatever we're emitting from our smokestacks, from our exhaust pipes, is being absorbed down the road by the forest. Quite the contrary. It goes up into this bucket that's above us.
I see.
And it stays there for 100 years.
Okay.
And nothing we can do can change that, you know, scientific fact. So the forests, yes, we have to think that the forests will have to be there for 100 years for them to start to absorb that carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Now, I don't want to come across as an anti-environmentalist. In fact, I'm one of those nutcakes, you know. I recycle everything, you know. I hardly drive. I mean, I really watch what I do. If I bought a new car, it would get 40 miles to the gallon or I wouldn't buy it. I mean, that's the way I am. And I'm very conservative of everything. I'm a minimalist in everything that I do. And I like the outdoor stuff. I go biking and hiking and running and stuff. I'm 65 years old. I still do those things. But I'm very conscious of that. Where I see our big obstacle is that even if the United States and some other countries, maybe Australia and New Zealand, for example, went full bore and decided that we were going to be a totally green country, which would not be possible, but if we did and we went nuclear power, wind energy, whatever the case may be, geothermal and whatever, and our emissions were reduced dramatically, and the same thing in Australia, New Zealand, a couple other countries, we still have, you know, Brazil, India, Russia, and China et al., and all of these emerging Eastern European countries and the former Soviet Union who are coming on stream like gangbusters. China alone, I understand, is opening a new coal plant one a week. We couldn't do
That's
one a
correct.
Year if we tried.
Correct,
where do we go with all of this? I mean, is this not the left hand that doesn't know what the right hand is doing type thing?
Well, let me just quote you some statistics I happen to have, and which are mentioned in the Ovum Factor, the book that I've written. On an average basis in the world, the average individual contributes 4.5 tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year, and that's based on the year 2004, although this statistic was published in November of last year.
This
is published by a report on climate change, so by scientific people rather than by governmental people.
Allow me
so
to just
the average for the entire world is 4.5.
Or 4.5
tons per person.
Per person. I just want to get this right because I don't want to be talking at a 4.5. You mean I emit 4.5 tons?
No, Joe, you emit 20. You're an American.
Okay.
The Americans are averaging 20.6.
Oh,
the
okay.
World,
okay.
The world, and that includes Canadians and Americans. The whole world is 4.5.
Okay.
And we in Canada are 20.0.
Okay.
You in the United States are 20.6.
Okay, I'm the bad guy. Okay.
No, you're the bad guy. But when you said, where do we begin? We begin where the problem is greatest.
Right, okay.
And let me mention some other countries. France, which has a high amount of nuclear energy, their average is 6.0. And they're a modern society with cold winters and with lots of power needs. They average 6.0 tons.
Right.
Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom average about 9.8 each. So we're double. We're double the Germans, we're double the Japanese, we're double the British. We're more than three times the French.
Okay.
And we're almost four times the average for the world.
Okay.
So Canada and the United States are really the starting point.
All right. What about China at this point? I mean, apparently the cities in China are so bad. In fact, many of the Olympians will not even go to China because the air is so bad. They won't even compete there. I heard that. I couldn't believe that, but I mean, that's what I heard. I thought that was just maybe a comment. But
The air quality is very poor. The air quality in China is very poor. I've been there five times in 2007. I just came back from a trip there 3 weeks ago. And yes, it's a chore to visit any of those cities. The pollution is tremendous.
What is there?
But if you look at it on a per capita basis,
okay.
If you look at it on a per capita basis, on an individual basis, they are a fraction of what we're generating in terms of emissions.
Right, because they have over 1 billion peasants, which are basically living.
Well, they have 1.3 billion people.
Right.
Many of them working in factories, making our clothes, our toys, our household utensils. And still, with all that production activity, they still average a fraction of what we do in Canada and the United States.
Right. Because of the 1.3 billion, I understand a friend of mine went to China. He said something like a billion of them still live on with dirt floors and huts and whatever. I mean, they're still backwards.
Well, there is a rural China, which is quite different from the urban China. But I would say that Chinese cities are modern places, equivalent to any city you would find in North America, except for a very high amount of pollution because they burn coal rather than oil. And coal tends to create a lot more urban pollution.
Yeah. Okay. Now, so what's, in your opinion, what's our solution?
Well, I think the starting point, and that's one of the factors which motivated me to write The Ozone Factor, the starting point is to sensitize people to the threat that we face with this climate change. Climate change is a very abstract term. People, they can't really put their minds around, what does that mean, climate change? If I tell you earthquake is not just uncontrolled shaking. Earthquake, to you, is toppled buildings, collapsed bridges,
correct,
roads overturned, people crushed, people dead, people dying. That's an earthquake.
Right.
But when I tell you climate change, what do you visualize? What do you say? Oh, 2 degrees warmer. It's hard to appreciate. What does that really mean to me, a 2 degree climate shift?
Right. It doesn't sound like much to me. It doesn't sound like much. We have
to
no
you,
problem.
Imagine, Joe, if you go to sleep at night in Tulsa, and you have to worry about being bitten by a mosquito because you're going to get malaria. That's a 2 degree shift.
Right.
That malaria becomes the problem not just for the people in South America and the people in Africa, where it kills 14 million people every year, but becomes a problem in North America as well.
Right. Okay. See, I don't think that way. I think the summers get a little warmer. I'll have to put on a little bit more sunscreen.
Well, you see, that's it. I think people like myself who are writers of fiction have to make people understand that climate change is just an abstract term, and we have to look at it and see what are the consequences of climate change, not just the fact that there's a slight temperature variation. The consequences can be devastating. Flooding of coastal areas, drought, famine, all the things that lead to war. These are the direct results of climate change.
Right. Just allow me station identification, folks. This is Liberty Talk Radio. I'm Joe Cristiano. This evening we are interviewing Mr. Marvin Zimmerman. He's the author of the book, The Oven Factor. It's about our environment, and we are talking about our environment. If you'd like to call in, it's 646-652-4620. Okay, Marvin. So what are some... there are those who subscribe to the fact that we should be good stewards of the earth. I mean, no one
yes.
would object to that. I mean, no one says, no, we shouldn't. We should burn coal, you know, the earth be damned type thing. But there are those who caution that some of the solutions may be as disastrous to us as a people, as a society, as doing nothing. I mean, there's got to be a balance somewhere. For example, there's some people. I read an article recently that subscribed to the fact that we should buy local because we save all this. And then I read a rebuttal to that, and the rebuttal made a lot of good points. It says, you know, you buy local, that means we go back to the literally go back to, couldn't go back to the Middle Ages. There are some advantages, but there are a lot of disadvantages, and we have to take all that into consideration. Do you have any concrete solutions that have no big negative counterparts to it, basically?
Joe, I wish I was a genius, like talked about.
You mean you're not a genius, and I have you on my radio program?
I'm not a genius. I don't have any solutions. You know, Richard Branson, the famous billionaire from the UK, has yeah. offered $25 million prize to anybody who could find a way of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And so far, nobody has been submitting any applications because
right.
it's a almost impossible task.
Right, right. Well,
I don't have any solutions. I conduct my life in a responsible way. I try to sensitize my family to living responsibly, not wasting. But more important, I want to sensitize large numbers of people to the fact that we just can't go on with this idea of more of the same.
Right.
We just cannot live the same as we've been doing in the past and pretend that it's not going to destroy us, because it will eventually. And eventually, in this case, is not 1,000 years, but more likely in the time frame of 50 to 100 years.
Correct. In fact, we have to be concerned for our children, our grandchildren. And that's how close it is. And I think there's yeah. many people who will agree with you to varying degrees, but everyone will agree that we're not going in the right direction. Let me ask you this. What are the type of things that you do that you would recommend that others do? I mean, other than saying, hey, guys, you know, be more responsible, and then we all stare at you and go, oh, I thought I was being responsible, man. You know, what do I do? Help me.
A very good question, Joel. What can people like you and I do? I think that we have a possibility to do something in two places, the boardroom and the bedroom. Do you hear me, Joe?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, please.
All right. Let's start off with the boardroom. Now, the most powerful person in the boardroom of a corporation is not the CEO or the chairman of the corporation. The most powerful person in the boardroom is the customer, people
Correct.
Like you and I.
Correct.
The corporate moguls know it, and you should know it too, and Right. your listeners should know it.
Correct.
So how do we get companies who cause the greatest damage to our environment, how do we get them to change their practices? Well, we write to them telling them that we no longer intend to buy their products or services, and we intend to spread this message to our family and friends.
Right.
So I think if we can identify companies who are causing environmental degradation, companies who generate unnecessary waste, companies who pollute the environment and who do nothing about it, nothing to correct that pollution, well, by advising them, by stopping to purchase their products, we can eventually have an important effect on their decision-making process.
All right, let me get a little political with you. Is not yes. our government the biggest polluter?
Well, the governments pollute us with their words, but I don't know that they pollute the environment. I think they are also bad stewards of the environment, because governments are beholden to many different constituencies
right.
and don't always make intelligent decisions. In fact, very often they make counterintelligent decisions.
Let me
agree.
Allow me to get on my high horse for a second, okay? Just and yeah. bear with me. We should have a Department of Defense. A Department of Defense means exactly that. You know, like in the martial arts, there's defensive martial arts and there are offensive martial arts, you know, and there's different terms given to each one. We have a Department of Defense. That means should someone be attacking us, we would have the mechanisms to repel the attack. Yet, our entire military complex is made up primarily of offensive weapons, very few of which are here in the United States, but overseas, using up a tremendous amount of fuel, everything from aircraft carriers, supporting battleships, and destroyers and whatever, airplane, you know, planes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, you name it, transports, et cetera, using a tremendous amount of fuel, many of which use tanks and whatever, use diesel fuel, which is not the cleanest burning thing in the world. So I said, what I see here is I see a government gone amok, you know, all over the world, I mean, using a horrendous amount of energy and creating nothing but antagonism around the world. I mean, it just drives me nuts when I hear, and it drives me nuts when I hear the government talk about, you know, the ecology and what we must do. I go, hey, you know, you first, guy. You know, me, I'm staying home. I ride a motorcycle. I got it in the garage. I don't even take it anywhere. You know,
yes, it's a very good point you raise.
I get angry at that.
Yeah, a very good point you raise. Certainly the army, the military establishment are notorious polluters.
Yeah, so, I mean, we have our own government who is not setting the proper tone example. I mean, how could the government do any, I mean, and they're in bed with the industrial military complex, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems like this thing is so incredibly big. And then they come down to me, Joe Blow, you know, and my two-cylinder motorcycle and say, Joe, you have to go green. You know, I look at him, I go, I think we have a problem here.
Yes. You raise a very interesting point, and it's there is, of course, a balancing act between the needs for a military operation sustained all over the world and the type of climate effect, ecological effects, due to burning diesel fuel from aircraft carriers, tanks, airplane fuel, jets that are constantly flying, never land.
Right. I mean, I would love to know the number of the number of gallons of fuel that our military uses, not here in the United States to defend the country, but overseas in offensive type of operations, which they call defensive, but offensive type of operations, it would boggle the mind, I'm sure. I mean,
well, I can give you a number.
We would be energy independent overnight.
Joe, I can tell you a number that in 2008, humanity will pass a milestone. And that milestone is burning 1,000 barrels of oil every second.
Oh, my goodness.
That means that in the time it took me to tell you this, we just burned 5,000 barrels. Now make that 6. Now make that 7. You get the point?
Yes. Well, a problem that I see is that there is plenty of... There's a lot of oil around. Unfortunately, it's not all attainable. Some of it is very difficult to extract. Much of it is encased in tar sands and whatever, and requires energy just to release, etc. You know, many of it is in countries that are very politically unstable and difficult, you know, to maintain a refinery process there. So where does all this bring us? I mean, how do we get out of this mess that we're in that's not getting any better? I don't see it getting any better.
We have to get out of fossil fuels. It's as simple as that. If you're a religious person, you have to ask yourself a very simple question. If God had intended us to use oil and coal, why would he have put them so deep underground?
Because he didn't want us to use it. He knew how bad it was.
He didn't want us to use it. That's right. Why did he put wind and sunshine above us on the surface where we live? And why did he put things like coal and oil so far below the ground? Because we were never intended to use them.
Right.
Well, we have to get away from fossil fuels. There's no other solution.
They say that if...
And there are ways to do it.
How could we do that? Because I read somewhere that if we established all of the wind farms that we have, you know, in the budget and projected out for the next 10 years, at best it would account for less than 2% of the energy needs of the United States. That's wind energy alone. But it would kill 15 million birds a year. And they say that that's the problem, that it kills birds. So 15 million birds would get tangled up in the blades every year. And that's the dark side, by the way. But for whatever it's worth.
Well, how much is spent on investment in the oil and gas sector every year? It's 1,000 times what they spend on investment in looking
absolutely
for renewable
right.
energy.
Yeah, right.
And therefore, there are problems with renewable energy that need to be solved, of course. One of them is the effect on birds. Another is the fact that wind energy is not yet very efficient, that it's not very predictable. Sometimes the wind blows, sometimes it doesn't. But these are solutions that humanity can find because we have the technology and we have the skill. We put a man on the moon 40 years ago. We do have the ways to develop these renewable sources, but we don't have necessarily the will.
That's correct.
My own feeling, Joe, is that the people who are involved in the oil and gas industry and the coal business, they don't have an interest in developing renewable energy because it's a direct competitor to them.
Yeah. Well, surprise.
And they are at the same time big investors in it because they want to be the ones who decide how fast
they are.
Oil is replaced by wind energy.
Right. In fact, one of the biggest wind farms here in the United States is actually owned by Royal Dutch Shell, believe it or not.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, so who dictates the pace at which we change wind for oil?
Right.
It's the oil company. Now, they have billions and billions of barrels sitting in their vaults. It's like money in the bank. They can't allow that money to become obsolete. They want wind energy to become important only when there's no oil left in the vault.
Good point. And if we said that that didn't exist, we'd be totally naive. Absolutely good point.
Now, very naive. In fact, my second book, Joe, is called The Last Noble Truth. I'm just now finishing it. And it talks specifically about the oil industry and their process to delay the development of renewable energy. And it does so in the form of a fiction, another eco-thriller, which combines intrigue, romance, and adventure, but has an important underlying theme, namely that there are people who are counterproductive to the solutions that we need to find.
Right.
We have to identify who those people are, and we have to identify how we deal with them.
Okay, good point. Now, what form of energy do you think holds the most promise?
I would say wind.
Wind? What about nuclear?
Well, nuclear is, of course, an excellent source, but there are some very serious environmental risks associated with nuclear energy I don't have to tell you about.
Right.
If you look at Europe, let's look at the European power grid. Europe right now is, in my opinion, 20 or 30 years ago. I can talk intelligently about this because I publish a magazine in this field.
Right.
The European power grid is increasingly being based on wind, on solar energy, on renewable sources. And they're using the wind from the coast of the Atlantic coast all the way from Spain up to England. They're using the solar energy from North Africa. And they're using the hydropower from Norway and Scandinavia.
Okay.
So the European power system is becoming greener. Whereas in North America, with the exception of Hydro-Quebec and a few other utilities, most of the power comes from burning coal or oil.
What percent at this point is the European Union relying on alternatives other than oil? Fossil fuels.
Well, it's still comparatively small, but the important thing is that they have a plan. They have a plan and they have a timetable for enacting that plan. So they're working towards a solution, whereas we're still debating whether we need a solution.
Okay.
In my opinion, that puts them light years ahead of us.
Will the free market be able to do this more effectively than the government? I have a distrust of government altogether.
Yes.
I'll be honest with you. If the government does it, it's not going to happen. You know that. I mean, it's going to happen very
effectively. The government is a poor steward of the environment simply because they have a very short-term way of looking at it. Their goal is to get elected, and then the next goal is to get reelected.
Correct.
So they're trying to do too many things at the same time in order to think long-term, which is what you need to take, a long-term approach to find such solutions. If you look at the European Union, they have a procedure, a bureaucracy that's working towards long-term goals that's independent of the governments who are in power. So even though you may have a change in government in France or in Germany, these projects are going on under the surface, independent of who's in power. And they are being handled by this enormous European Union bureaucracy.
Right.
And we may say that bureaucracy is inefficient and counterproductive, but one cannot argue that the Europeans are light years ahead of us in terms of dealing with the threat of climate change.
Right. Would you be a proponent of more nuclear power to energize electric-type cars? Or would you think that's a foolish way to go, or maybe just trading one problem for another?
We might be trading one problem for another, yes, because nuclear energy, as clean as it is, as I said, has some very serious potential risks.
Right. Yeah.
Comes with some very serious risks.
I guess then the neutralizing, I guess, I'm sorry, I don't know the terminology, neutralizing of the spent fuel rods is not a science that's with us today.
I'm not that familiar with nuclear energy, so I can't comment. I know that the people who are in the utility industry who are burning coal and oil are looking at a novel solution. They're thinking that rather than pushing the emissions up through smokestacks, they're going to bury them underground.
Right.
This is the type of thinking that's going on now at universities and in the laboratories. They're saying, okay, if we're going to burn coal, why do the emissions have to come up into the atmosphere? Why not pump them into the ground and bury them there?
We don't trade
deep
one
cavern.
Yeah, we don't trade one problem for another. It seems. I mean,
well,
hiding it doesn't seem to.
When you bury,
you know,
all that carbon dioxide in the earth, you have to hope that the earth is a stable structure, because we know that the earth is not a stable structure.
That's correct.
Cracks appear,
right?
And suddenly to release all that huge amount of trapped carbon dioxide in the form of, you know, a volcano or an earthquake, well, the potential risks are also very great.
Right.
I think we should move away from this technology rather than trying to find ways to make it more palatable.
Right.
I think we should move in the direction of wind and solar energy and hydro energy, which is what the Europeans are doing.
Right. How do we make that transition without government regulation that sort of tilts the marketplace? I mean, contaminates the marketplace to a point where nothing seems to work right, and that's what typically happens. That's my concern. I mean, if solar energy was viable, I would spend the money, go out, and I'd have my roof with solar cells tomorrow. I would do that tomorrow because I always like to look long term. I don't mind spending $10,000 today and saving, you know, $300 a year. I mean, I think that's a good investment, in my opinion. But I know I'm doing the right thing for the environment, so it makes me sleep better at night. I'm a softie. What could I tell you? But how do we do this without the government, you know, coming in, forcing industry to do this, and then skews the economics of everything? For example, when about 30 years ago, the government gave homeowners a tax incentive for 75% of the amount that they spent on anything that was solar energy and stuff like that, they would get a 75% basically rebate from the government. Well, you know what industry did? They raised the prices of it three times. So instead of something cost, let's say, $1,000, it cost $3,000. And then the company said, well, the reason why it cost $3,000, you're getting $2,000 back from the government. So basically the taxpayers pay for it. I mean, whenever the government gets involved, it doesn't work. There's always a loophole somewhere. So I don't know how you do this without getting the government out and having industry come in and make it a competitive market type situation.
Well, we have to do this. We have to tackle this problem not on a national level, but on an international level, because the problem is not, you know, it doesn't stop at the border. You know, pollution from Mexico doesn't stop at the Rio Grande. Pollution from the United States doesn't stop at the 49th parallel. It's an international problem, and therefore governments alone cannot deal with it. It has to be through cooperation, intra-governmental cooperation, as the Europeans are doing it.
This is
and
where
I don't know whether the United Nations is the right forum, but
yeah.
I think this conference on climate change, the scientific community that's organizing an effort to identify the problem and to find solutions, we have to rely on them rather than individual governments.
Well, this is
what our government can do is to at least allow those organizations the support that they need and not to be countering to their activities.
Marvin, we have a caller. Hold on, please. Caller, you're on the air. This is Liberty Talk Radio. Your first name and where you're calling from, please.
This is Jim from Tulsa.
Yes, Jim, your question, please.
Yes, I've been listening to the conversation. Very interesting. And Marvin, first of all, I applaud you for your writings and your efforts behind the environmental movement.
Thank you.
I have a couple quick comments and questions. My brother has shared a lot of this with me. He is one of part of the Al Gore's army. Has been to Nashville and been trained on his climate change initiatives and does public speaking in the Columbus, Ohio area. In fact, is running for Congress and using the environmental issues as one of the main aspects of his platform. But that aside, so I've been indoctrinated and informed through my brother. But I have other issues and concerns. First of all, some of the alternative methods of energy that you've mentioned, wind and solar, I've heard have some limitations as far as being practical in a lot of energy uses because of their intermittent nature. You know, if you have a few cloudy days or have a few days of no wind, if the source needs sustainable energy, you know, those technologies have not developed enough to because of their uncertain and intermittent nature. I'd like you to comment on that. And then my follow-up question was, realizing that it is in fact a global issue, like you said, the pollution doesn't stop at the borders. I have concerns, as Joe does, one about too much government involvement and regulation and taxing, and second, if there may be some unscrupulous organizations or leaders that may have ulterior motives behind some of these treaties and carbon tax ideas. And I just am concerned about, as you know, this is a libertarian talk radio show, and many of us have concerns about protecting our nation's sovereignty and what our founding fathers formed this country on. Yet obviously this solution is going to take a concerted global effort. So
yes.
I'm a little uneasy about that, and my first question about those alternative energies being viable for reliable continual as a reliable continual energy source.
All right.
Comment on both those.
Yes, I'll be happy to, Joe. In the first case, electrical energy doesn't have to be consumed where it's produced, meaning that a power plant in Tulsa could be supplying customers 50 miles, 100 miles away, and that's done through overhead lines. Now, there are places in the world where wind is intermittent. Sometimes wind blows, sometimes it doesn't. But I lived for 5 years in southern Spain, and I can tell you along the Atlantic coast of Europe, the wind blows all the time.
Right.
So if you build wind farms over there, they are producing electricity almost constantly. If you go to North Africa, to the Maghreb, to Tunisia, Algeria, northern Libya, it's sunny there 350 days a year, almost all the time. That's where you produce your solar energy. And where are the rivers constantly running, where the hydropower is constantly being regenerated because of the enormous amount of movement of water? That's in the north, in the northern European park, in the Arctic areas. So by setting up power production in those areas where the wind is reliable, where the sun is reliable, and where the water power is reliable, and then transmitting it through overhead lines or through cables to consumption centers, then you overcome this problem of intermittent natures. Of course, I'm not saying you should build a wind turbine outside your home and rely on it to generate electricity because maybe the wind won't blow for 6 months in Tulsa.
Right.
But I can tell you there are places where the wind blows all the time.
Right, right. Okay, well, so obviously not only the development of those technologies, but then geographically based on the local environmental conditions and climates, be smart about what technologies you employ.
That's right. You use those renewable technologies where the environment, the climate is such that the sun, the wind are predictable based on history. Now, the second question you ask about too much government regulation.
And the global is that the global is the need for this to be a global effort. But I have a lot of reservations about the United Nations and the World Bank and a lot of global organizations. I feel aren't necessarily in our countries and our sovereignty's best interest. And so I have some apprehension about embracing some of these global initiatives. But I also realize it's going to be needed for this
yes.
problem.
Yes, I agree with you that many of these global organizations are highly politicized, and they are run by people who have very short viewpoints. They're basically trying to stay in power, trying to get reappointed in their positions. I think this problem has to be tackled by people like scientists.
Yes.
People who are not from the political arena, who are not trying to get reelected or to be reappointed to their position, but who are dedicated to a scientific philosophy, who are dedicated to some scientific goal. These people don't change, they don't flip-flop. They are sustained thinkers. They follow through on what they began with. I think it's time for the scientific community, through cooperation between universities and through scientific organizations, to take the lead and identify the scale of the problem, propose solutions, and to evaluate which of those solutions are the most workable, the most likely to succeed.
I agree with you, and I appreciate your answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, now, Marvin, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I have all these buttons in front of me, and one of these days I'm going to press the wrong button. I'm going to lose my caller. On this Thursday morning, I have a live show coming up, and the title of that program is broadcast is going to be Ethanol and World Hunger. What is your opinion of the biofuel process that we're now subsidizing with taxpayer money, et cetera, et cetera?
I'm against it.
Okay, and why is that?
Well, because if you go to Brazil, as an example, Brazil is the country in the world where they have the highest amount of alcohol-based fuels. In fact, almost every gas station there sells alcohol alternatives
right.
to gasoline, to right. conventional gasoline. I'm against it because in order to grow sugarcane and corn and all these other crops that contribute to this ethanol production, you have to cut down huge areas of forests. And when you do so, you disrupt much more than that. You have a more negative effect in terms of the impact on the people who live there, the impact on the creatures who depend on the forest, and of course the effect of the forest itself
right.
on keeping a global stability, because forests are a repository for global stability.
Right.
They absorb, they regenerate. Without forests, the earth is much more vulnerable to sudden shifts. So cutting down a forest to grow corn to replace oil, to me, is simply exchanging one problem for the next.
I always thought it was the dumbest thing in the world because we're using, you know, corn, which is uses a tremendous amount of water, and then it's being subsidized by, I mean, I can go on for an hour. I had two programs on that, and it drove me nuts. I mean, I almost
yes.
ate the microphone. I got myself upset just talking about it, but that's another
yes,
story.
Yes, it's politically wonderful because you say, look, we're not buying oil from Saudi Arabia now. We're buying ethanol from Iowa.
You know
that
what
sounds very good to an American saying, you know, why should we be sending all these petrodollars to the Middle East where they're, you know, they're funneling that money into organizations like Al Qaeda? Let's support, you know, the American farmer. Let's support homegrown fuel.
Well, you
but
know, we
if you
never
really look at it.
Yeah, Marvin. What we never say, we never tell the public, is we only get 17% of our oil from the Middle East, and not all of it from Saudi Arabia. Most of our oil comes from Canada, and we never say damn Canadians, you know? It's just interesting and fascinating. All right, very good. Well, anyway, this coming Thursday, I'm going to be live on a program. It's going to be Ethanol and World Hunger, and I plan to make a case for that. Let me give you, we have about 4 minutes left. Let me give you, leave with these 4 minutes to talk about maybe your book, what you're doing, and do a little advertising for yourself or whatever, okay? Why don't you just take off on that?
All right. I'm a new author. The Ovum Factor is my first book, and but not my last. I've already mentioned that I'm now completing my second book. The Ovum Factor, which readers can find out about at my website, which is www.theovumfactor.com, is a new genre of book, an eco-thriller, which is built around these important issues which affect all of people living on Earth, namely the issue of environmental degradation. And if people read such books and they become sensitized to the problem, because I think that's the first step to solving a problem, is to become aware of the problem and not to dismiss it as an artifact of some ardent environmentalist or some people who don't have any foot planted in reality. So as a writer, I hope to create an awareness in the average individual, the book-reading public, that there is a problem looming out there. And it's not a problem that will affect us in 10,000 years, but will affect us in less than 100 years.
Right.
And when people understand the magnitude of the threat ahead of them, I think they're more likely to discuss this with their families, with their children, and modify their lives accordingly. It doesn't take much to save energy, simply turning off unnecessary lights, keeping water, turning water off when you're brushing your teeth,
right?
Bringing bags with you to the store instead of using bags that are given to you by the store. All those small things, if we correct our behavior, they make a big difference at the
right.
end. Remember, the average North American, Canadian and American, are producing 20 tons of carbon dioxide every year versus 4.5 for the average for the entire world.
That is amazing.
So we are the place where the problem is greatest, and we are the place where the people have to become sensitized that we something about our lifestyle is having very serious consequences for the environment.
Yeah. Can I ask an oddball question? I've never asked this question before, but just because of the subject involved, has your book been translated into Mandarin for the Chinese public? No, I'm serious.
This is only made available in February,
okay.
I'm hoping that it'll become a success in North America. And, of course, I think my book involves China a lot. And I hope very much that it'll be translated not only into Mandarin, but to many other languages.
Yeah, considering that they are the up-and-coming polluter, I figure that they would benefit by that book as much as we would.
Yes, I think The Ovum Factor will be available, hopefully, in Chinese, in German, in French, Japanese. And I hope that you'll have an opportunity to read it, because if you read those three chapters and you say you find it a fast read, it is. It's a page-turner.
Right, it's a page-turner. It was fascinating. And I'm a slow reader, and it had me reading fast, so I'm going to get that book, I promise you. And another thing, if you will send me your mailing address to comments@libertytalkradio.com, that's comments, plural, @libertytalkradio.com, mm-hmm. I would be more than privileged to send you an official Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt. For being a guest on our show.
So.
Okay?
I'll be happy to do so, Joan. I appreciate the time that you gave me to discuss the Ovum Factor and my own feelings about the environment. It's been a very enjoyable experience for me.
Oh, thank you so
and
much.
I want to congratulate you on your show. I think it's a very interesting theme.
Oh, great, and thank you so much. We are privileged to have you, and thank you so much. Folks, this is Marvin Zimmerman. He is the author of The Ovum Factor. Please buy the book, okay? Marvin, thank you very much, and good night.
Thank you, Joe. Bye. Goodbye.
Good night. Wow, that was great. That was fascinating. You know, we've had some very, very interesting guests. And we have guests coming almost every Sunday now for the next, I'm not sure about this Sunday, but in the next, on the 27th and on May 4th, we have two other guests that will be fascinating. We may have someone next week. I'm not certain yet. But tune in this Thursday morning, 6:30 a.m. live, and we're going to be talking about biofuels or ethanol and world hunger. And thank you so much for listening this evening. I really enjoyed that interview. He's a gentleman, a true gentleman. This is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends and let us hear from you. Our email address is comments@libertytalkradio.com. That's comments@libertytalkradio.com. Remember, you're either allowing your liberties to be taken away or you're striving to protect them. Unfortunately, there's no middle ground. And remember, folks, don't steal. The government hates competition. Until next time, that's Thursday morning, 6:30 a.m. And by the way, this will be rebroadcasted constantly. Stay well. Stay tuned.